should be, you should be allowed to ask him anything you ever want about Nagesa. He answered everything there was to hear about.
Indeed. Oh, thanks a lot. I don't know if I'm fresh or exhausted, but a bit of both. Sorry? Right, no, that's for sure. Yes, first of all, thanks to Sarah, especially for the invitation to come here. It worked very well to combine this with Ann Arbor. So it's really nice to be here on my first trip to Canada. So thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm here for the week, and in fact, I'm in the office just that way, 304. So if you have more questions after, you're very welcome to come and see me until Friday. Okay, so that's just, well, my name, Chris Burns, title. Okay, I'm from Bielefeld, for you don't know. That's up in the north of Germany, near Hanover, which maybe you've heard of. I give a couple of the main references, there's other work. There's more in preparation and a whole good bunch of collaborators. Okay, so Kari Engqvist, Misha Gerstenlau, who's a student in Heidelberg, where I was before. Sami Nomi, Tomo Takahashi, and Japan, Janmasuma Tasanato, and David Wands. Okay, so there's quite a strong group working on this, and there are also people here, like Sarah, who's also worked on this, and Louis, in a slightly different perspective. But this is, well, more generally, I'll be talking about scale dependence of non-Gaussianity, and things like the four-point function or going to higher order. The idea is, how much can we learn from cosmological data? Right, the basic challenges we have a paradigm of inflation, which may be right, but we don't know what is the fundamental theory behind it. Even if we did know, we don't know what are the right constants, the coupling constants within the theory. We don't know initial conditions, so right, there's a great deal we don't know. And I know people here are working on that, but so far I haven't had the answer. So I figure we've got to do both ways. We've got to build up a fundamental theory, and we've also got to look at the data and hope that the two will meet one day. So that's the idea behind looking for as many observables as possible, and that's where my work comes in. It's sort of based on general phenomenology, seeing what sort of general signatures can we look for in the data. Okay? So what do we do at the moment? Well, we have a million pixels in the CMB sky, right? And people can compress that a million data points to something like order of 10 to the 4 CLs, which define your power spectrum, right? So just very loosely, you've got 10 to the 6 data points, which goes to something like 10 to the 4 CLs. Of course, with Planck, everything will increase. And this goes to basically, in terms of inflation, two numbers, right? The power spectrum being some amplitude times some scale dependence, ns minus 1, right? So we've gone from a million to two numbers plus some cosmological parameters, like omega matter, omega lambda, etc. Now, is this justified? It's justified, right, if it's a Gaussian and isotropic. Anything beyond that, and we need more parameters. And of course, from a theorist's point of view, the more parameters, the better, because the more we're learning about the fundamental theory. So that's some motivation to do what's actually very complicated, especially for observers, right? To correlate the sky on three-point or four-point functions, there's a lot of work, right, to correlate so many data points in every possible way. But hopefully I'll convince you that there's also a lot of reason to do that. Yeah. Okay, so non-Gaussianity could be anything. This is another challenge, right? It was described in this meeting as being a non-dog. So everyone knows what a dog is, and everyone knows what a Gaussian function is. But a non-Gaussian thing could be anything. So we don't want the observers to look for absolutely everything, because you're bound to find detections by chance. Right? So it's also good to see in advance what models expect you to look for, and then look for those sort of specific templates. And then you should understand the significance of any detection you may find. Okay, so how much can we learn with non-Gaussianity? That's basically the question. And as I'm sure you know, there's lots of ways to look for it, right? There's the CMB sky, there's large-scale structure, the abundance of rare objects, where you're probing the tail of your distribution, right? Which is where you tend to be sensitive to non-Gaussianity. There's also this scale-dependent bias we heard a lot about in the meeting, to do with sort of the difference between the matter distribution and where light is coming from. So lots to look for. Okay, so I'm going to talk about mainly two things. Scale dependence of the bispectrum. And two, trispectrum. But it's no problem to generalize as far as you like. You can calculate scale dependence of this, so you can calculate 5, 6, 7 point moments. I know Louis has done that sort of thing up to, what was it, 25? Or?
Yeah, simple calculation.
Right. So in some cases, you can really go far. The question is, to what point can you push the observers to come along with you as well? Okay. By the way, please interrupt at any point. This is right informal. It's a blackboard. So first of all, local model. This is what I'll define as the very simplest and the most sought-after model. So zeta is your curvature perturbation, which you can think of as your temperature perturbation on the CMB sky, or as in your density perturbation, which you would use for large-scale structure. But this is at a primordial time, so before you've had to deal with all the complicated non-linearities of sort of late-time evolution. Okay, so this is in fact what the vast majority of observers have looked for, is to think that you have some, say, temperature distribution, which is given by a Gaussian, which we know is a good approximation from observations, to something like 99.9%, plus some deviation. And the simplest thing to do is to think of the square of a Gaussian, right? Some chi-squared non-Gaussianity on top of that. And if you like, you can go to higher order moments. And at this level, F and L, it's just right the modulating the amplitude of your non-Gaussian term, and it's just a constant. That's it. But of course, this is not always the case, and in fact, I'll try and convince you that generally it's not the case. This is a reasonable approximation for lots of models, but it's not exact, except in very special and sort of fine-tuned cases. Okay? So more generally, we can define this nonlinearity parameter, completely generally, as the ratio of the bispectrum of 3Ks. Okay, so this would be given just by my three-point function of this curvature perturbation in Fourier space, normalized to the power spectrum. So, okay, one. Plus the cyclic. Okay. These permutations here, so that this definition is completely consistent with the previous one. But of course, in general, right, this can be a function of three variables, which are, right, you can think of as just your three side lengths of a triangle. Okay? Right, for the power spectrum, it's just a function of one number, which is one length scale on the sky. Okay, and then you can think of taking two points on the sky given by a fixed length, and then map them everywhere, take the average. For this, it's a bit more complicated. You've got to take three points, which is a function of three variables, do the same, and see what you get. Yeah. Any question? This is just introduction, but I know not everyone here is maybe. There are some complete experts in here, and maybe some non-experts, so please. Please stop me. Okay. So if you're all good with that, we're going to look at what should you expect from data and what should you expect from model building. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about one particular model. Doesn't have to be your favorite model, but it's a very simple model where I can sort of motivate first the local form and then every sensible generalization. So I'll talk about what's called the curvatome model. Now, I'll tell you that if you don't like that, if you prefer other sorts of models, a huge class of models all follow in the same way. They're just a bit harder to show what's going on. So I'm going to focus on this curvaton scenario. right? So it's given by some Lagrangian, which is... So first of all, we need an inflaton field, just to cause the inflation. The point of the curvaton is that you have a second field, so it's some multi-field model. And for the beginning, I'll just give it a quadratic potential, the simplest thing to do. We'll later see what happens when you go beyond that. And of course, things get more complicated. Okay. So during inflation, the idea of the curvaton is that this is highly subdominant to the inflaton. So you've got two light fields, one of them driving inflation, the other one just fluctuating but not doing much because it's subdominant. So at some point, of course, so the Hubble rate, right, is decreasing during inflation. So at some point, the mass of your curvaton field is going to become order of the Hubble parameter. So we have rho chi. Okay. Until the mass becomes order of h. And that's a distinction between a light or a massive field. H is your energy scale. Then what happens after? Well, the inflaton decays first. So it decays into radiation. Right, so rho radiation is like 1 over a to the fourth power. Right? But your curvaton field will oscillate in a quadratic potential. So it will just go like matter, like 1 over a cubed. Okay. So the energy density of your curvaton is going to be growing relative to the inflatons. Or the inflaton decay products for some unknown time until it decays, and that's basically a free parameter of your theory. We would like to have a fundamental theory and say what it is, but for the minute we don't. Okay. So just the point of this is that we have some model parameter RD, which is the ratio of the energy density of the curvaton, right, to the total. The time the curvaton decays. Okay, and after this it decays into radiation, and so this becomes a constant. Before that it's a growing function. And the interesting case to look at is when this is a small parameter. Okay, so your curvaton, it's extremely subdominant during inflation. Because of this it starts to become more important, but it stays subdominant. Okay. So, well, what happens? It's quite easy to work out. Okay, so you have rho chi. Okay, simple as that. Right, I'll just split it into some background homogeneous part plus a perturbed part. Right, and of course, I'm thinking to go from here to the curvature perturbation zeta. All right, because it's the imprint which we'll see on the CMB. Of course, the curvaton itself has decayed. Yeah. Okay, so this gives us perturbed part is okay. And you'll see I'm dropping all numerical factors because they're boring. And they're not useful for the purpose of the talk, but of course in the paper we will include everything. Okay, so you can see, because this is field perturbation of a light field, it's basically a Gaussian perturbation at the time of horizon crossing. Right, so already now you can see why we're looking at something like a local form. You've got a Gaussian and the square of a Gaussian. Well, the other thing is that if you think of the equation of motion, it's as simple as that. And this is what's really nice about a quadratic potential, and one reason people like working with it, is that it's exactly the same equation for the perturbed variable. Right? So I can do that, which implies that it's a constant. Okay? And that alone is a big motivation to calculate it with the quadratic, but I'll encourage you to go beyond that, and certainly from an observational point of view, we shouldn't be too fixed on predictions which were made just using calculational simplicity as a motivation, right, rather than something deeper. Okay. So now we can use this to think about what is my total curvature perturbation. Right, I've got this part, and remember there's also an inflaton field. And people sometimes like to neglect the inflaton. But I'd say that's a bad idea, because we have delta chi is order of delta phi at horizon crossing. Okay, so star is when k equals ah, it's when the modes are across the Hubble scale. This is order of h star over 2 pi. Okay. So all of your light fields are perturbed the same amount. So it's when people say, well, I'll reduce the energy scale and then I'll neglect the inflaton, right? You can't really do that because the curvaton is still also being reduced. Yeah. So. So when you do the calculation, it's very simple. True in the limit that r decay is much less than 1, the inflaton and curvaton are decoupled. So this is a standard result, right, for single field inflation. That power spectrum is just the square of this, meaning 1 over epsilon times delta phi squared, okay, which is h squared. You include the curvaton, so you include its perturbations, right, at both linear and nonlinear order, and that's all there is. Right? But you have to modulate this according to how much is the energy density of the curvaton, right? Because you're interested in the total curvature perturbation, not just the one of the curvaton. Okay? And we don't need to do the same here because I'm assuming the curvaton is subdominant. Right? Otherwise, I would. Yeah, but it's not important. Okay. The other thing I'll just say is that these two fields are basically uncorrelated, again, because they're decoupled. There's not much interaction during inflation, so the two-point function of phi and the chi is zero. Okay, so let's first look at the pure curvaton limit, which is what most people do. They neglect the inflaton. Well, as I said, that's not terribly motivated. That's so. Your curvaton, well, what's my Gaussian perturbation? It can only be this part, right? Because there's no inflaton. This is. Okay. And then, so if you look at this part and compare it to the definition, you can see it's exactly the definition, right? Except we've got to take the square of this guy. So you would take an r squared here, but there's only an r, so f and l is 1 over r decay. Right, simple as that. So you see, the more subdominant the curvaton is, the bigger the non-Gaussianity. That's a simple result. But you may be a bit skeptical, and you wouldn't be wrong, which is right. This guy, 1 over epsilon, that's a big number. Right, by construction, for inflation to be valid, this has got to be big. Right? And remember, this we want to be small in order to have any signature. Right? So you see that typically we should include both. And it's a fine-tuning of the VEV of the chi field evaluated at horizon crossing in order to keep this term large. Yeah. Okay. Any questions so far? Too simple? Okay, I'll ramp it up. Okay. But hopefully it's clear to you here that it's sort of motivated to include, right, to include the effect of the inflaton as well as the curvaton. Okay, so let's include the inflaton. So now our power spectrum, right, I've got to include, at tree level, I just include the Gaussian terms. Right, so I've got to include these two terms. Right. Okay, so I've got two power spectra, and they sum up to the total thing which we observe. And there's no cross-correlation because they're uncorrelated. So, bearing in mind, okay, we can define it like this. If lambda is this is obviously positive, because the two-point function is always positive. Can I keep writing, or am I too low? Yeah, you can see. You're good? Okay. So now the bispectrum. Well, nothing changes, in a sense, to the bispectrum, right? Because the two fields are uncorrelated, I can only form a bispectrum by taking two copies of my Gaussian term and Gaussian squared. Right, there's no way I can form a contraction with a delta phi, which gives me a non-zero contribution. So the bispectrum is simply the bispectrum of the chi field, and that's a standard thing. Right, and if we look at what this is, well, the power spectrum has right in r to k squared. So let's go ahead and calculate FNL, but now including, right, including the inflaton and the curviton. It's okay. This is basic definition. I'm suppressing the k dependence just to keep it simple. Okay. So remember, the bispectrum is due to the chi field, the power spectrum due to both. So of course, that's going to change things, right? Okay. So in fact, the non-Gaussianity will be reduced by this, right, factor 1 plus lambda squared, which is, of course, bigger than 1. So we see that our prediction has been changed, right? It's got this new factor which wasn't there for the pure curviton, but how can we know it? And, a priori, we've got no idea what r to k is. So an accurate measurement, no matter how good, even if someone said FNL is 20 plus or minus 10 to the minus 5, we'll never get there, but even if we did, right, it wouldn't really help. So how can we find lambda? Well, there are two ways. And the two ways are, did I rub it out? No. Indeed, scale dependence, or to look at the trispectrum. I'll show you that we even have a consistency relation, if we can find both of them, to know what is lambda, and also to test other assumptions which are put into the model. Yes, with logical structure. Right, with CMB you wouldn't see that. But, yeah. Okay, greater than two ways. Okay. So, let's first look at scale dependence, like over there. So first, if lambda, sorry, if r decay is a constant, it doesn't depend on scale, it's just some time when the curviton decays. Right, so in the single field model, FNL is really a constant. It really exactly satisfies the local ansatz I wrote down at the beginning. But now if lambda is not equal to zero, then what happens? Well, FNL, it's proportional to the power spectrum of z to chi squared, because that's what the bispectrum reduces to. Just think of Wieck's theorem over the total power spectrum. Okay. So this is k to 2 times the spectral index of the chi field, right, minus the spectral index of the total of which we actually observe, right, ns. Okay. So this scale dependence, which is a unique feature now of having included two fields, simply minus 2 times n chi minus ns. Okay, so that's one thing we can look for. And you can ask, well, how big should it be? Is it interesting? As I say, I'm not an observer, but in certainly one natural limit, natural and simple, you can have n chi is 1, meaning that the curvitron field is really scale invariant, so when its mass is suppressed. So this implies it's minus 2 times, right? This is the observed power spectrum from the CMB data, which we know is it's not quite scale invariant, and that's a big result from WMAP. This is something like order of 0.1, okay, with a healthy error bar. But the point is, this number is the sort of thing which Planck could detect if the non-Gaussianity is there at a level which is still allowed by current present-day constraints. So from a very simple case, right, I haven't done much. I've had a quadratic potential. I've included an inflaton, but didn't need to say anything about it. We see we get some scale dependence, which is not negligible. So this is an interesting result.
So saying n chi is
1
for the
n
squared
chi squared? No, only when it's very subdominant. Sorry, when the mass is small. It doesn't need to be, but it's a reasonable limit. I'm not saying it's the unique prediction.
Has there been any constraints? Since it's subdominant, the contribution will 2-point.
It doesn't need to be. That depends on lambda. Right, if lambda is small, then of course the spectral index from the curvitron itself cannot be scale invariant, right? Because of observations. So this only works if lambda is somewhere between 0 and 1, not too close to either, one or the other. Yeah. I just want to give you a ballpark figure here, which is reasonable, it's not.
The curvitron will pick up time variation in H.
Right.
So it's really just saying that the curvitron hits the kind of the epsilon piece in ENSO S, but not the delta, not the
right. I mean, yeah, to be more explicit, n chi, well, minus 1 would be minus 2 epsilon plus 2 e to chi star. Okay, well, e to chi is to do due to the mass of the curvitron.
Right. So right. You can set the mass. Very small,
yeah,
that.
Indeed. Well, you can either
still have the epsilon piece from the
of it. Right. But if you're in a small field model of inflation, then that's negligible. Yeah. I'm not. As I said, this is not the prediction. It's just to give you a ballpark. Yeah. And then your eta from the inflaton would have to be giving you the observed spectral index. So in fact, it would have to be negative then. Yeah. But right, that's a hilltop model. It's didn't realize there was this here. Okay. So as I said, this is sort of borderline detectable, or maybe, and also with large-scale structure in the data, Sarah's done simulations, even including a scale-dependent FNL, and that's a future constraint, which hopefully we'll do better, but further into the future when all the systematics are understood. I think that's fair to say. Okay. Any other question? No? If not, let's quickly look at the trispectrum as well. Yeah, that's just one. That's one case. Yeah, so the trispectrum is a bit more complex. It's a four-point function. So you've got to think about...
I guess I do have one question, actually. Mm-hmm.
No problem.
So more or less, if you want the non-Gaussianity to be big, you want the curvitron field to be within roughly h of its minimum during inflation.
No, it doesn't need to be that close. No.
It
It needs to be small wave.
You basically want the delta chi squared to dominate over the delta chi.
It doesn't need to dominate. It can't be too much smaller. But remember.
So how is there basically? My question is: is there a thought about how to, you know? I guess if both fields are light during inflation, why will one have relaxed close to its minimum, or the other one not?
Indeed, that's a very good question.
People thought about a physical mechanism to do that, or it's just sort of a thing.
I mean, it's normally just treated as a free parameter. People have thought about it in various constructions, and I haven't looked too much into that. But I'll just say that chi doesn't need to be as close as delta chi. Because remember, this thing, the perturbed variable from observation is like 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah.
So this thing, this term here, the square, is 10 to the minus 10. So if F and L is 100, right, we're talking about a 0.1% non-Gaussianity. But it's still with what looks like a large number. And the point is, R decay, right, this can be very small without great problems. So there's certainly a tuning on chi, and you're very right. But, well.
Yeah, but you can also. It's a stochastic variable. Yes, it's a free parameter. Technically, the variable can't be anything. But there is a PDF, just, you can say. So you can ask exactly how much tuning in the model. And I don't know exactly. I mean, right, if you can quantify how much of the tuning you have precisely. Because unlike the other parameter in the theory, that one has both the distribution function as a derivative.
Right.
So that one is the one parameter which is free technically, but you can really tell how much you're tuning it.
Yes. I mean, if you have some sort of uniform distribution for the initial. Or if you've or if inflation's gone on long enough, right, to relax.
Yeah. Okay. Assuming that it reaches the stochastic.
Right.
But in principle, it's actually nice because you can.
That's true.
Compared to other parameters, which are really. I mean, you can add whatever derivative in this thing or whatever. This one you can just ask: is this a sensible value in the late time limit where I have stochastic?
Right. Yeah.
So I guess you could rephrase Nathan's question by asking, given that we can calculate the new can you tell whether is it always true that to get larger than the sanity you need to be somewhat tuned away, like more than say one or two symbols?
No, I think you don't need to. No. Because it certainly, as I said, it can be significantly bigger than order of delta chi. I might talk about this at the end. That's when you get the loop corrections, in fact. If this term is really as big as this term, then you've got to include in your three-point function, right, the cube of this term as well as your first order squared times your second order. But that's actually, at that point, the curvatron breaks down because you would have too much non-Gaussianity. Other things kick in, so.
But you would expect it to be a small number based on this
argument, right? Right.
Say it another way, for the normal interest field, I guess the delta chi over the displacement of the minimum is typically a ratio of 1 over 60 times 10 to the 5.
Say that again.
Isn't that right? The delta.
I'm not sure where that's coming from. Are you thinking of phi driving, of the field driving the inflation, or?
I'm thinking of the field driving inflation. I'm saying comparing this to the field driving inflation.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
It has to be first delta chi over the displacement.
Right. So phi star, it's order of, It's something like, I think, 4 times the total number of E-foldings, which is like square root of 240. Right, in Planck units.
Yeah,
right. And the other field, of course, is much, much less than that.
Right.
Yeah, and certainly sub-Planckian. Very sub-Planckian.
So maybe it's this.
But it's not.
They're very different.
That's certainly true. They should be coming from sort of different branches of physics, yeah. And that's consistent with the fact that you're treating their two decay times independently. But it is a tuning, yeah. But the other way to look at that, of course, is to say, well, I have inflation, we seem to need it, unless Neil Turok sticks his head around the door. And then we have some second field, which is light and light decaying, some, right? It may be there, and what are the best constraints we can find on it? What should observers look for to see if it was there or not? And right, this is the sort of signatures we're looking for. Whether it's likely to be there, I really don't pretend I can answer that. And whether it's likely to be a big signature or a hidden one, yeah, I don't know. Okay, so trispectrum. I was going to say things are a bit harder. Right, we can think of defining it with one length, then another length, an angle, another angle, right. There's lots of freedom. So in fact, you have 6 variables. Right. In 2 dimensions. Right, because first you can think of one length, then you have a choice of an angle, the second length, third angle, third length, and then a final angle, and then you have to close. Right. It would be 9 variables if you allow a 3-dimensional thing, so if you're looking at large-scale structure. So on the plus side, we've got potentially lots of information. On the negative side, firstly, it's a very small thing. I'll show you why. And secondly, it's clearly, right, very computationally intensive to correlate in all possible ways if you've got 4 points to consider. Another thing is with a bispectrum, there's sort of just one term. If you think of like Feynman diagrams, there's one tree-level diagram. For the trispectrum, there are 2. Yeah, 2 terms. Okay, so we have a linear squared, and a second order squared. This goes to what's known as tower now. Okay, but the other thing is I can take a first order cubed. Right, remember first order means Gaussian, times a third order. And this goes to what's known as GNL, which is related to the kurtosis of your distribution. Okay. And both of them, in the trispectrum, it's of order power spectrum cubed to get a non-zero result, which is disconnected. Right. If you think of Wick's theorem, you have a disconnected piece, which has no new information, plus a connected piece, which is the exciting part. Right, so this is order of the power spectrum cubed. Right, so it's also a small effect. But in principle, there are lots of different configurations, so you can average them all up and still get a decent constraint. Right. You just need a big computer and patience. Okay, so let's quickly see what happens for the trispectrum. Right, what new can we learn from it, from both of these terms? First, let's go back to lambda equals 0, meaning pure curvaton, right, just to see what is the so-called standard prediction. So if tau now, t zeta over, right, this is really a definition. It's convenient to define the ratio. So that in order one factor is sort of the natural, right, natural value. You've taken out the dependence on the amplitude of zeta by defining it this way. Versus 1 over the square of r decay, which is simple if you go back to this formula. Right, the power spectrum has an r decay squared. The four-point function, well, you'll take basically 4 of these guys. Okay. But now you have a power spectrum cubed on the bottom, so that leaves you with this. Okay, and this is nothing else than F and L squared. Okay, so this is in fact completely general consistency relation if you have what's called a single source model. Yeah. So it's consistent. By single source, I mean not single field in the sense that this is true beyond the inflaton, but I mean that there's only one field direction present during inflation which generates a curvature perturbation that we see today. Right, it could be any one of them. But this is a test. If that's true, then we always have this relation between the trispectrum being the square of the bispectrum. Okay.
Do you know what is that?
It depends on the value of FNL. If FNL is close to the current constraints, then that's definitely detectable.
Is it with Planck?
Yeah, exactly. So FNL, right, is something like less than, I think, between minus 4 and 70, 2 sigma range, right? Something like this at 2 sigma. And current constraint on tau null is very weak. It's less than like 10 to the 5. Okay, and this is a positive quantity, right?
Is the always a much stronger constraint of time now than the rational structure, or is that the strongest?
That's currently the, say, the strongest, within a factor of a few.
There was a 10 to the 3 constraint thing every time. Maybe that's just what it's meant.
10 to the 3? No, I.
Well. But GNL is more.
Yeah.
No, worse. If you look at the way they write the constraints, they may have sort of disguised how big it is, but no, GNL is actually worse. There are 4 constraints. This could be negative. And this is less than basically between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6, but I would say more like 10 to the 6 if you think about systematics.
Forecast for what Planck can do,
10
to the
3? Forecast, yeah, tau and L, it's 10 to the 3, well, even maybe better. So Kogo Komatsu have an old paper predicting 560, very precise number. Joseph Smith, a Santa Curia, and others relooked at that and said, well, a bit worse, a factor of 3 worse, say. But yeah, that's worth writing.
And is that basically, that's cosmic variance limited up to?
Right.
That's where that is
coming. Yeah, so it's optimistic. It's assuming you subtract all the foregrounds. Yeah. I mean, so Planck forecasts, yeah, I'll give you the approximate numbers. So it's at sort of 2 sigma, it's FNL less than about 10. Right, assuming no detection, but hopefully that there will be. Tau and L sort of 10 to the 3. And GNL a bit worse, unfortunately, more like closer 10 to the 4. Yeah. But remember that these things are multiplying much smaller numbers. Right, so if you still look at the effect of this on the amplitude of the curvature perturbation, it's still a very tight constraint. Okay, so we're looking at least an order of magnitude jump for the trispectrum, possibly closer to 2 orders, if they can implement the optimal constraint and have enough computer time to really do it.
So you're not even allowing the time to be negative. I mean, I know that it would be extremely surprising,
yes,
given that it's a square of a number.
Right. Well, the observer is, yeah.
But I mean, this condition could be wrong.
Yeah, yes. Right. We had Komatsu give a talk about this. Although the explicit example doesn't work. I've checked out.
The people are not even constrained on
that. Actually, yeah. The observers don't care if it's positive or negative.
Right,
they just constrain it. Right.
So you should still put an absolute value.
Okay. Yeah. If you don't believe in the theories behind it, then I agree. Yeah. Okay. And of course, the same for this. Yeah. Right. But to go back to your question then, if... Right, so if F and L was order of 20, 30, then we would expect a detection of both of them. Right, so we would expect some test of this consistency relation of tau and L over F and L squared. Is it one or is it different? And in fact, that's an active topic which was discussed in the meeting. So, well, my next line fits very nicely onto this, in fact. Okay, what happens here for lambda not equals zero? So now for two fields, not a single source, well, it's more or less the same calculation I did for F and L. Right, you have the trispectrum of zeta, but that only comes again from the curvaton. Okay? Divided by the total power spectrum, which is due to your inflaton plus your curvaton. Okay. So this is simply squared and cubed. Okay. And now let's substitute in F and L, but for the case where we had both. Here it is, right? So we substitute that in, and now we can compare again the trispectrum and bispectrum. Right. So this is F and L squared times 1 plus lambda. Okay. And remember, this is, of course, greater than 1. So this is enhanced. So in fact, if you have multi-fields, and this is much more general than I've shown it here, it's quite possibly completely general. There are some questions about what happens if you include loop effects. But if you don't, then it doesn't matter if you have two fields, five fields, or 1,000 fields. This relation remains true, that adding more than one field gives you a larger tau and L than the square of the F and L. So that's a good motivation, again, to go and look for this, as hard work as it may be. Yeah. Fingers crossed we find it. Yeah. Another thing is we can, again, think about the scale dependence, if you're optimistic, of tau and L. Right? It's going to be fairly simple. This is proportional. The trispectrum breaks up to the power spectrum cubed, right, due to the chi field.
That's kind of a general result, with the only assumption being that the various fields are uncorrelated.
That they're Gaussian and uncorrelated. Yeah. The uncorrelated part is actually not a big deal, because if they're Gaussian, that's saying something about the strength of your couplings between the fields, that they're small. And you can then check that the correlation between the fields is also going to be small. The bigger deal is whether they were Gaussian, and if you have something like a non-canonical kinetic term, then your fields are already non-Gaussian at horizon crossing. Okay, and then you get different forms of non-Gaussianity. But again, that's not actually a huge problem, because this non-Gaussianity from horizon crossing looks very different in the data. So if you have non-canonical kinetic terms plus multiple fields, you'll get one form of non-Gaussianity called the equilateral from this horizon crossing interactions, which is peaked for a triangle with all three sides the same length. And you also get this sort of local non-Gaussianity, or quasi-local, which I'm talking about, right, which is in fact peaked in a squeeze limit when one of the k's is much smaller than the other two. Right, so if you measure the bispectrum for plenty of cases, you can tell the difference between them, and same for the trispectrum. So, So yeah, we can see the difference. Okay, I'll hurry up with this board. So this is k. The only difference is instead of a square, I had a cube. So 3n chi minus n. OK, so. So indeed, there's another consistency relation. So we see that there are lots of ways to try and determine lambda from this theory. Any questions here? I think I'll leave this blackboard then.
That's one is true irrespective of lambda.
Irrespective of
lambda.
or
yes, irrespective, yeah.
It's always
well, again,
you're saying it's true for any number of field two.
That I'm not saying, no. No, it's true for two fields, but in the limit that lambda, right, that you have just the curvaton field, both of these things are going to zero, right, because you're recovering scale independence. In the limit that you only have an inflaton, the nonlinearity parameters are going to zero. But technically, this remains true for absolutely any value. Yeah, but for two fields. Whereas this inequality is true for even more than two fields. I haven't actually looked at what happens here for multiple more fields. We could check. And maybe there's an inequality. Yeah. Yeah, I see I'm running a bit out of time, so I want to say a couple more things. Okay. So one thing is, well, just the final comment here was this parameter with GNL, it's simple to see it's going to be zero, right? Because we only could expand the quadratic function up to second order. There's no higher order term. Right, so that's even another test. Was that over here, GNL is equal to zero. So now let's add a self-interaction and see what happens. And of course, all hell breaks loose. Self-interacting. Curvaton. And here I'll drop delta phi, just because it's complicated enough and the time is against me. So instead, I'll include the quadratic term, which we need at some level where you're oscillating so that the curvaton energy density grows, plus but I'll include some extra term, right, with self-interaction. And this, of course, is makes life harder. So I introduce the parameter S, which is basically, right, this term, your strength of the self-interaction, normalized to the quadratic part. And we'll see that even a small self-interaction actually makes a big difference. So this is 2 lambda. And normalized at the time of horizon crossing, k equals ah. Okay, afterwards, of course, the smaller chi gets, the more you can drop, right, your higher order corrections. Okay, so one needs one more parameter, unfortunately, here. Right, you've got more freedom, which I'll call chi zero, which is a function of chi at horizon crossing. And here, this t zero is the time of oscillation. Okay. So remember, initially your curvaton is sort of held steady, but at some point it becomes heavy, it starts oscillating. And this is the difficult thing. And because now, all right, delta chi is not proportional to chi, because we have added self-interaction, so the equations of motion are different. And that's really what makes this hard and why you need numerical results. We can see what happens, though. FNL, you get your standard result, one over r to k, but plus some extra stuff. Okay, and derivatives here are with respect to the value of the field during inflation. So as I said, this is you typically can't do analytically. Your scale dependence, the okay. These are the formulas you get, and at least the formulas are analytic. The problem is you can't calculate these derivatives analytically. Okay. So one thing to notice, remember FNL is proportional to 1 over r to k. Right? So this is independent. of r decay. And it depends on the strength of the self-interaction, right, the third derivative. And in the limit of a quadratic potential, meaning s equals 0, you will recover a scale independence, right? Simple as that. And the other thing is then, this is, right, depending on r decay, which you can tune, right? So any value of nfnl and fnl, provided that this guy should be positive, and that's the only constraint. Otherwise, right, from the data, we could, in principle, see anything. Right, all combinations are possible because you've got two parameters in the model, and they show up very differently in the observables. So it's, again, showing the power of going to, right, higher order observables. We can probe things you can't probe otherwise. You can also give GNL. And this is, instead of being 0, as it was before, it's going like 1 over r decay squared, which, remember, is a huge thing. And then times, well, maybe I won't write it explicitly, some function of phi 0 and the derivatives. Okay? So generically, this is order of fnl squared. Right? So it's gone from being 0 to actually being large. Even for a self-interaction S of order a few percent. It's quite surprising how quickly you go away from what looks like quite a firm prediction by adding just a small extra term, which I would argue naturally you probably would expect to be there. Okay. And we can also think, what happens, right, this term could just happen to cancel, right, if chi double prime is negative, and that's true for certain values of the initial conditions, even just if you add a quartic self-interaction. Right? So if this becomes close to 0, then you would have G and L. It doesn't cancel in the same range, I won't show you, but it's true. It's much, much bigger than F and L squared. So the first signature could be the kurtosis, this G and L term. And you also have a large scale dependence. This can even become order of 1, but then our approximations start to break down. Okay. And just to give one more general result. Okay. Again, for what we call single source, which, remember, is just any other field. About any one field which generates a curvature perturbation, you find in FNL, it's given by the third derivative over h squared times square root of the RT. Now, this has nothing to do with r decay, it's the tensor to scalar ratio, okay, which is a small quantity over FNL. Okay. But remember, this self-interaction, there's basically no constraint on it. And h squared is tiny, but v double triple prime doesn't need to be at all. The spectral index is not sensitive to that because the variable of your field is small. So in fact, this is the only way to probe a self-interaction of some isocurvature field. Even you might think, well, what about the power spectrum? What if I look at, say, the high derivatives, such as the running of the spectral index? Naively, you would expect to see this signature there. And for the inflaton field, you do. But for a curvaton field, in fact, you don't. The third derivative is very heavily suppressed by the fact that the inflaton is not moving quickly. Yeah. So this is really the only way I know to probe higher order derivatives, interactions of some field which is subdominant during inflation. How am I for time? Not so good.
Essentially.
Yeah, let me, a couple more lines and then I'll conclude. Sorry. Let's just stick in a formula for equiperiodic, because I'm in perimeter. There's a very simple result, at least for the simplest realization of the equiperiodic scenario, which is FNL goes like minus 1 over the spectral index. Okay, and you can see that this is going to be in trouble, right? Because we're close to skin invariant. So this is already pushing at the upper bounds. Of course, you can then add more terms to the ekperiodic, and you can go, you can suppress this. But this was the original, or the first prediction for the new ekperiodic scenario when you have two fields. Right, and we can also see, of course, right, if there's a running of the spectral index, then you will also have a running of FNL. Right. In FNL, this is going to be minus alpha s, which is the rate of change of the spectral index. It's something which is constrained but not detected at the minute over the spectral index. So, and this is generically a first-order quantity consistent with predictions from other inflation models. So what's nice is we there have a consistency relation, so that would be cool. Okay, I think given I'm out of time, I think I'll skip the loop corrections. Sorry to Louis, but we can discuss after. Just to say in one word, because it goes back to a question you asked, if delta chi and chi really are of the same order, if they're both order of h, right, then you should include your sort of second order term squared as being as large numerically as your first order term. So you've got to include all of the higher order correlations. And this introduces through the convolution some logarithmic term. So it looks like you've got some logarithmic running with scale. And right, so a different type of scale dependence, but also interesting signature. Okay, but I'll stop here. Well, so I'll just conclude to say that some scale dependence, I hope I've convinced you, is really completely natural. Right, if we see non-Gaussianity, we may not. But if we do, then it's a signature that you had multiple fields. These multiple fields will typically have different scale dependences. Right, and so this will show up as a scale dependence of things like non-Gaussianity. We would expect that. We would also expect some self-interactions of fields. And this is a second signature, so we can probe both of these things. And if we can look at both the bispectrum scale dependence and the trispectrum, you can really decouple all of these effects, and we have the potential to really know a great deal about the early universe. So, stop there. Thank you.
In terms of in trying to get a handle on what I should realistically expect in terms of how well Planck will do with tau and GML, so you were saying that maybe a Santa Curry or somebody like this took the cosmic variance limits up to the respective highest L mode of Planck and estimated as kind of big. And so then what will that be degraded instead mainly by foreground contaminants, or will it be instead by it might be instead by, like, to go up to the highest L of Planck and calculate the trispectrum is very computationally intensive, probably. Right.
Indeed, it is. Yes.
So it's like longer than the age of the universe computationally intensive, it sounds like how many pixels? I would have imagined that
the order of 10 pixels
to the fourth power would be the calculation.
That would be the naive estimator if you really correlated it. But they have better estimators. I think it's L max cubed for. There are certainly much smarter estimators than that.
Uh-huh.
But even using the smarter estimators, I think the Koko Komatsu was optimistic in the sense that they assumed the optimal estimator, which was not L to the 4, but it was still very intensive.
Yeah.
So Kure and those guys, they're looking a bit more realistically, but still assuming you can get rid of the foregrounds. But applying something like a mask, right, to say we're only going to see 60 to 70% of the sky where we can subtract foregrounds. And then that's the sort of thing which a supercomputer can do in order of months, say. So it's something we may reach, order of 10 to the 3. Yeah. But of course, we have to see what the real data is, and nobody really knows how big the foregrounds will be.
Order of 10 to the 3,
yeah. I think that is realistic.
So is it maybe you don't... Do you, I guess guess for the tri-spectrum, since you're not looking for scale dependence, it's not strictly speaking so crucial that you keep all the very small scale stuff. Is that right?
You lose signal to noise though quite rapidly if you throw away, because you want to look at configurations. You want to be able to look at configurations where you have big scales and small scales. I didn't write it down, but the k-dependence of your tri-spectrum for tau and L. It's like tau and L times, there's a 1 over k1 cubed, k2 cubed, k1 plus k3 cubed. Plus, I think, 11 permutations. Okay. So you want one of the k's to be going to 0, or for the sum of two of the k's to be going to 0, to maximize the signal to noise. So you want to be able to probe a big lever arm anyway, even before you think about scale dependence. Yeah.
Is there an efficient, the local shape has an estimator which is often efficient than the main?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it has a piece which is just linear, essentially, between the 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
The Townell and GNL, they're more efficient with the seconds or the special shape.
Right. I don't think there's an optimal in the sense of what Kendrick-Smith developed for the bispectrum. Certainly not an optimal plus computationally feasible one. Right, that's why there's no more debate about what's possible as well, because there's not sort of one gold standard of estimator which people are using. Yeah. But let's say, though, this constraint that I'm saying for GNL, it's not a weak one, right? Because you have a Gaussian, which is 10 to the minus 5, plus FNL Gaussian squared, right? Plus GNL Gaussian cubed. Okay, so this is 10 to the 15, and then something suppressed by, say, 10 to the 4. So overall, right, this is, say, 10 to the minus 11, or this is 10 to the minus 5. So it's still, right, you're suppressing your kurtosis term to 1 part in a million. In my mind, that's still fairly good. Yeah. But I think there's a lot of room for work on the tri-spectrum. If anyone wants a challenge. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it just makes it sound very interesting to know the basic thing about whether, given you had one natural prediction for a typical size for tau and L there.
Right, sort of bigger than FNL squared, bigger than or equal. Yeah.
Yeah.
For GNL,
it would be interesting to know if you can. Given computational limits, is that known? In other words, you were saying there was this paper that didn't take into account computational constraints, just took into account cosmic currents.
Right.
Got down to 10 to the 3.
Whether it's optimal, I'm not sure.
Basically enough to roll out that thing. If FNL were, there's a regime allowed currently where FNL could be big enough that you could roll out that. Roll
sure.
Out.
Yes.
But is that? It would be interesting to know if you could say, given additional computational constraints, mm-hmm. that there is not an allowed regime in which that.
No, there still is. This is allowing for sort of computational. There might be a factor two here, but FNL could still be, say, 60. So 60 squared is 3,000, say 3,500. It's certainly there, but it's true that the discovery space is getting small. Certainly when we just think about Planck. There's logical structure, of course.
Which actually might be different.
Yeah, it may be better.
In the pi spectrum, just like the bytes, so
mm-hmm.
it's more.
So a survey like Euclid or some, right, sort of next decade survey, if you can understand the modeling systematics, that's expected to be better than Planck. And by the way, for For another thing, like nFNL, it's expected to get to order of 0.05. Again, if fNL is towards the upper bound of what's allowed. Yeah. Right, so there is a discovery potential for all of these parameters.
Yeah, I think this is really worth emphasizing that the Darcy structure of protein numbers is crazy. What was the one, the fNL of 0.1?
Oh, well. Yeah. Does anyone take that seriously?
No, but it's merely the Darcy structure people are saying it can be better.
Yes.
FNL 0.1 meaning the
FNL 1. We can reach that.
So you mean that's like you mean where they're just going to see the guaranteed signal that's just due to non-linear.
Yeah, they will see gravitational.
Oh, definitely. They will in fact be much bigger if FNL is 0.1. Primordial. So in fact then, right, the big challenge is to subtract all of the secondary effects through, right, the nonlinear effects of gravity and to know exactly what is the primordial piece. It's a big work in progress, I think that's fair to say.
The guaranteed signal is something like FNL.
That's already for CMB. For logical structure, it's even bigger. It depends how nonlinear you're going, which scales you're looking at, right? The smaller the scale, the bigger the effects. They're secondary. Yes. So that's exciting. But we may have to wait a while for the large scale structure. Whereas Planck is in 2 years. Right now. January 15th, 2013, that's when the field's going to jump forwards. Yep. Spoiler Christmas.
Okay, thanks. Huh?